From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
What our country is doing is illegal, and I don't want to be a law-abiding citizen of an outlaw nation. I've never been involved in civil disobedience before, but based on the actions of the Bush administration, I felt like I had no choice.
Ben Cohen of Ben and Jerry's joins peace activists and religious leaders in arrests outside the United Station for protesting war against Iraq. And actor Martin Sheen speaks out against war and for Philip Berrigan.
Physically, he's gone from our midst, but spiritually, he'll always be with us. Wherever the truth is spoken, wherever action is taken on behalf of the poor, the marginalized, the voiceless, wherever the gospel is taken personally, Phil Berrigan is present.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States warned Iraq and other countries yesterday it's prepared to use nuclear weapons in response to attack from weapons of mass destruction. The threat came in a six-page declassified extract of a top-secret directive signed by President-elect Bush in May. The document reads, "The United States will continue to make clear it reserves the right to respond with overwhelming force, including through resort to all our options, to the use of weapons of mass destruction against the United States, our forces abroad, and friends and allies." The Washington Post reports a classified version of the strategy goes even further. It breaks with 50 years of U.S. counterproliferation efforts by authorizing preemptive strikes on states and terrorist groups that are close to acquiring weapons of mass destruction or the long-range missiles capable of delivering them. In a top-secret appendix, the directive names Iran, Syria, North Korea, and Libya among the countries that are the central focus of the new U.S. approach. USA Today is reporting the Pentagon is preparing to use anti-personnel landmines in a war with Iraq. This despite U.S. policy that calls for the military to stop using the mines everywhere in the world except Korea by 2003. The Pentagon has already stockpiled landmines at military bases in several countries ringing Iraq. The United States has refused to join the 146 countries that have banned the use of landmines. The United Nations estimates up to 20,000 people are killed or maimed worldwide every year by landmines. 80% are civilians, one-third are children. It turns out that last week wasn't the first time Senate Republican leader Trent Lott has publicly lamented the fact that Strom Thurmond didn't win the 1948 presidential election on a pro-segregation platform. At a 1980 rally for Ronald Reagan in Jackson, Mississippi, Lott said of Thurmond, "You know, if we'd elected this man 30 years ago, we wouldn't be in the mess we are today." Then Thurmond declared, "We want that federal government to keep their filthy hands off the rights of the states." For any supporters and opponents of civil rights, the phrase states' rights stood for the rights of states to reject federal civil rights legislation. Last week at Thurmond's 100th birthday celebration, Lott said, "I want to say this about my state. When Strom Thurmond ran for president, we voted for him. We're proud of it. And if the rest of the country had followed our lead, we wouldn't have had all these problems all of these years." Lott apologized Monday, saying a poor choice of words conveyed to some the impression that I embrace the discarded policies of the past. Nothing could be further from the truth. When Strom Thurmond was running for president in 1948, he said that he would consider calling in the U.S. Army to stop, quote, Negroes from coming to, as he put it, our pools, our schools, our churches. In the Arabian Sea, a North Korean ship carrying a dozen concealed Scud missiles was intercepted by two Spanish patrol boats about 600 miles off the coast of the Horn of Africa. Pentagon officials said the Scuds appeared to be bound for Yemen. In Venezuela, a general strike against President Hugo Chavez has entered its 10th day. Yesterday, the United States issued a travel warning to its citizens and allowed non-essential embassy staff to leave the country. The BBC reported oil production in Venezuela has plummeted to a quarter of its normal levels, that people are lined up for hours at banks, gas stations, and supermarkets. Yesterday, large rallies in Caracas were held by both supporters of Chavez and opponents calling for new elections. Backers of Chavez surrounded several TV stations to protest what they say is unfair coverage. On Sunday, Chavez accused most of Venezuela's news media of waging a terrorist and bloody war against his government. And in Washington, Henry Kissinger, the private citizen, yesterday convened a private meeting of prominent international business leaders and senior Bush administration officials in Washington to discuss U.S. national security. George Tenet, the director of the CIA, was one of the featured speakers. Kissinger was appointed last month by Bush to lead an independent investigation into the terrorist attacks of September 11th and the performance of the national security agencies, notably the CIA, under Tenet. Financial Times reports the gathering orchestrated by Kissinger raises further questions about whether the former national security advisor is too close personally and professionally to conduct an independent critical assessment of the intelligence agencies and the work of the U.S. national security community. War. Edwin Starr here on Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday was International Human Rights Day. To mark it, religious leaders and anti-war activists from across the country staged over 150 vigils, acts of civil disobedience, and marches from some 40 states from Alaska to Florida. The day's actions were organized by United for Peace, a new national coalition of peace and social justice organizations. In Chicago, 20 protesters were arrested outside a federal building. 9 more arrested in Sacramento, California. In New York City, about 100 people were arrested in front of the U.S. mission to the United Nations. In the afternoon, we got a call from the holding cell at 51st Street in Manhattan. Daniel Ellsberg was on the line, the longtime peace activist well known for risking life imprisonment by leaking the top secret Pentagon papers that exposed the truth about the Vietnam War. Democracy Now! Producer Mike Burke answered the call.
We are all here because we believe this coming war is wrongful, it's dangerous, immoral, it's reckless, highly dangerous, will increase all of our dangers, and we should not be preparing to kill people in such a situation. Therefore, we want to say as strongly as we can that this is happening without our consent, and it has to happen over our bodies. That's why we put our bodies in front of the U.S. mission at the U.N. today.
This is Rabbi Arthur Wasko. What I read today, just before we began the civil disobedience action, was a passage from the Torah, the Bible, in which resisting Pharaoh, who had commanded the murder of the children of the Israelites, two midwives, said, nothing doing. We're not going to do it. We affirm life. We're here to give life. That was the first act of civil disobedience that's been recorded in human history. And I think what we are facing now is a combination of governmental and corporate power, it's oil, and a government that has decided the United States can boss the world for the next century, and particular leaders who are getting off on doing that. Together, they make a kind of modern equivalent of Pharaoh, and they are about to murder many, many, many children.
This is Dr. Faz Khan. I'm here today in support of all the concerned religious leaders about the direction, the policy that's created from the corridors of power in D.C. is taking. I'm somewhat a little different in that I believe that there's been a perpetual state of war in the region of Iran for the past, decade or so, based upon the sanctions and the way we deprive the people. But the prospect of actual heightened military intervention is one that I think the leaders here are determined to speak out against as much as possible. So I wanted to join them today.
Ben from Ben & Jerry's, also the president of the True Majority campaign. Yeah, I got arrested this morning. I'm in a cell with a bunch of wonderful, wonderful people. And I took that stand because I think that what our country is doing is illegal. And I don't want to be a law-abiding citizen of an outlaw nation. I've never been involved in civil disobedience before, but based on the actions of the Bush administration, I felt like I had no choice.
I'm Peter Larman. I'm the minister of the Judson Memorial Church. It's a Protestant church in Lower Manhattan. And right now, I'm at the 51st Street at the 17th Precinct, NYPD. So there's every reason for religious people to be here. Plus, the history, James Lawson, in many ways the mentor of the nonviolence movement of the last 50 years, told the group last night that wars for the past 60 years have been outrageously destructive of the life of women and children. And clearly in this case. So there's no other place to be today for religious leaders but here in jail. But we do think that, those of us who are Christian think that for 500 years, Christians, in total contradiction of the Christian message, have been among the most violent, if not the most violent people, well, in fact, the most violent people on the planet.
We've been covering a lot over the past few days the life of Philip Berrigan, and I was wondering if you could comment on the importance of his activism.
Well, we dedicated a gathering last night, and here in the cell, we had a moment of silence, trying to honor the spirit of Phil Berrigan. We read a couple paragraphs from his collected writings. We're very much doing this. We obviously, no one knew he would be dead today, but we're very much doing it in his spirit and in his honor. His brother Dan was expected to be with us and be arrested today, but Dan, of course, took part in the wake and the funeral, so he's not back with us in New York today. I believe that nonviolent action in America is yet to have its hour. It had a bright, shining moment in the modern civil rights movement, but I think its hour may now be upon us. And I think that what we'll have, though, is a movement of nonviolence that is interfaith. In a way that far transcends the civil rights movement 40 years ago, which was interfaith but was mainly Jewish Christian. Our group has Muslims and Sikhs and Buddhists in it as well.
The Reverend Peter Larman of the Judson Memorial Church. He was following Dr. Faiz Khan of the Al-Farah Mosque in New York, Ben Cohen of Ben & Jerry's, Rabbi Arthur Waskow of the Shalom Center, and Daniel Ellsberg, who revealed the Pentagon Papers, all speaking to us from the holding cell on 51st Street in Manhattan. They were arrested along with more than 100 others outside the United Nations on International Human Rights Day yesterday. Many other protests took place around the country. And you are listening to Democracy Now! Coming up, we'll hear Martin Sheen remembering Philip Berrigan and adding his name to a list of Hollywood stars calling on Bush not to wage war on Iraq. But right now, former President Jimmy Carter has accepted the Nobel Peace Prize yesterday in Stockholm. He became the third U.S. president to win the award, joining Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Delano Roosevelt. In his acceptance speech, Carter warned a U.S. attack against Iraq will have, quote, catastrophic consequences.
Ladies and gentlemen, 12 years ago, President Mikhail Gorbachev received your recognition for his preeminent role in ending the Cold War, example of respecting human rights at the international level. Ladies and gentlemen, 12 years ago, President Mikhail Gorbachev received your recognition for his preeminent role in ending the Cold War that had lasted 50 years. But instead of entering a millennium of peace, the world is now, in many ways, a more dangerous place. The greater ease of travel and communication has not been matched by equal understanding and mutual respect. There is a plethora of civil wars unrestrained by rules of the Geneva Convention, within which an overwhelming portion of the casualties are unarmed civilians who have no ability to defend themselves. And recent appalling acts of terrorism have reminded us that no nations, even superpowers, are invulnerable. It is clear that global challenges must be met by an emphasis on peace, in harmony with others, with strong alliances and international consensus. Imperfect as it may be, there is no doubt that this can best be done through the United Nations, which another American, Ralph Bunche, described here in this same forum as exhibiting a fortunate flexibility, not merely to preserve peace, but also to make change, even radical change, without violence. He went on to say, and I quote, "To suggest that war can prevent war is a base play on words and a despicable form of warmongering." He said, "The objective of any who sincerely believe in peace clearly must be to exhaust every honorable recourse in the efforts to save the peace. The world has had ample evidence that war begets only conditions that beget further war," unquote. We must remember that today there are at least 8 nuclear nations on Earth, and 3 of these are threatening to their own neighbors in areas of great international tension. For powerful countries to adopt a principle of preventive war may well set an example that can have catastrophic consequences.
President Jimmy Carter receiving the Nobel Peace Prize yesterday in Oslo. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we turn now to Coleman McCarthy. Coleman McCarthy is a former columnist at the Washington Post and founder and current director of the Center for Teaching Peace, which helps schools with peace studies programs. He teaches peace studies at 3 public high schools in Washington, D.C., and 3 universities, including Georgetown Law School. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Coleman McCarthy. It's good to have you with us on the telephone. Hi.
Hello, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Amy. You know, I should tell you before we start, I have a wonderful picture of you, Amy, in my office of you when you were in Dilley with Alan Nairn. And both of you were beaten up that day, and I have this, it's not a great glamorous picture, but it shows you out there being beaten up by those cops. And I do value your work all these years.
Well, thank you. That was the Indonesian military armed with U.S. M-16s. As we talk about Jimmy Carter today, who actually did have something to do with the arming of the Indonesian military while he and Mondo was his vice president, can you talk about his record? You wrote a very critical piece about him in this month's issue of the Progressive magazine called St. Jimmy the Lesser.
Right. Well, you know, he's in... You know, he's a fine Georgia gentleman, but I do think his presidency was flawed. He was, even before his presidency, he was a former military man, went to the Naval Academy, believes in violent solutions to problems, as military people do, and they're funded by Congress. But he was a supporter of Marcos. He was a supporter of the Shah of Iran, Duvalier, you mentioned Indonesia government, and many others. His massive funding of the armed services was the greatest of any president up until then. He turned a deaf ear to the atomic soldiers, veterans. He was pro-death penalty. He supported the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. As Zbigniew Brzezinski, his national security ill advisor, was behind it and argued that It's always stir up a few Muslims over there, but we're going to liberate Central Europe through Afghanistan, the Soviet war. And so this guy has a lot to answer to, but evidently the prize givers don't take into account a full person's record. And I think Carter's one more example of this Nobel Prize given out to people who really, you know, who really are essentially, to use a strong word, frauds in the world of nonviolence.
The descriptions you're using of Carter in your conversation in Peace are certainly not ones we're seeing in the rest of the media. You say shortly after the Salvadoran Civil War began in 79, Roman Catholic Archbishop Oscar Romero pleaded with Jimmy Carter, Christian to Christian, not to send military aid. He was ignored. In March 1980, Romero was slain while saying
right.
Mass, and the
right.
Death Squad killers were under the command of men trained at the School of the Americas. Then you write that in December of 1980, the four American churchwomen were slain by the members of the National Guard of the Salvadoran Army. Carter did then suspend military aid.
But then soon after that, he began to send more.
Mm-hmm. More than
you know, obviously he's had a conversion, and you know, he's out banging nails with Habitat and groups like that, and he has a fine Carter Center raising money for conflict resolution. But usually when you have a conversion, you do a little penance for past. Sins or misdeeds. I haven't heard Carter say he's going to do any penance for this for his former self. Don't you think that's he claims to be a Christian, and said that that his Christian faith was his guiding principle of his presidency. Well, I don't know. I don't know what Christianity says if it doesn't say that it's about nonviolence and sharing wealth and not killing people to solve problems.
Coleman McCarthy, you end your piece by saying, although Carter's prize is not so offensively wrongheaded as Henry Kissinger's, Yasser Arafat's, or David Trimble's, he's not worthy to be in the company of laureates who genuinely took personal risks and defied corrupt power in their pursuit of peace.
Sure, I think that I mean even the Nobel Prize, you know, I mean even then it's kind of, you know, this Alfred Nobel was a dynamite, you know, inventor who said, oh, this is going to stop wars because this dynamite is so awful that people are not going to use it. So off people will be afraid to fight anymore. We got dynamite now. So even, you know, if you go back, you know, and it was given to Woodrow Wilson, and I think it was Theodore Roosevelt, Amy, not Franklin Roosevelt, that got the Nobel. And so these guys believed in wars. So I think that I think we ought to be suspicious about this Nobel Peace Prize unless it's given to people who've either been imprisoned or beaten, or, like Perez Esquivel from Buenos Aires, or Rigoberto Menchu, or King, or Aung San Suu Kyi, people like that who have had their lives threatened. But Carter, he's a millionaire. He's doing fine. You know, he's a nice guy. But you know, they gave it to Kissinger and people like that and Arafat. I mean, come on.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Coleman McCarthy, for being with us. In our next segment, we'll be joined by Martin Sheen, who is at the funeral of Philip Berrigan. Coleman McCarthy wrote Berrigan's obituary in the Washington Post this weekend. Stay with us.
No more murder in our name. You dare to call them freedom fighters. Call the butchers what you will. But from Hara to Allende, it is freedom that you kill. We are gathered here today, put our bodies in harm's way, at the school of death and shame. No more murder in our name. From Panama to Georgia. Georgia. We'll be always on your side. With so much blood upon your hands, how do you butcher sleep at night? We are gathered here today to put our bodies in harm's way.
You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. Actor Martin Sheen, who stars as the President of the United States in West Wing, joined over 100 Hollywood celebrities endorsing a declaration against a preemptive strike on Iraq. Well, on Monday, we spoke to Martin Sheen in Baltimore as he walked in the procession following the body of Philip Berrigan, his coffin being taken to St. Peter Claver Church, where the funeral was held for the legendary anti-war activist.
Here to celebrate the spirit of this great man, Phil Berrigan, who was a teacher and a prophet and an inspiration, besides being a husband and father and priest and just extraordinary human being. Last time I saw him, I was in prison in Elkton, Ohio. We visited him there just before 9/11, and gosh, it was one of the great visits. Joe Cosgrove, I don't know if you met Amy, and I went in with my grandson, who'd never been inside a jail before, Taylor, and he was just enthralled with this man, and he kept asking me, why is he in jail? What's he doing here? And I would explain to him, he was a peace activist, and you had to pay for peace. And so he spent, good part of 12 of the last 20, 25 years in prison, you know, because he believed the gospel. He believed it deeply and personally. He took it personally, and that's what we're required to do. If you don't take the gospel seriously and follow the nonviolent Jesus, then it's impersonal. If it's impersonal, it has no meaning. And Phil is a constant reminder of how deeply personal we must take the gospel to forgive our enemies, to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, to shelter the homeless.
Given where we are today with the U.S. about to invade Iraq, do you think what Phil Berrigan has done over the years has been meaningful, hammering on warheads?
Of course. You know, we're commanded by the command of Isaiah to beat swords into plowshares, and he did it symbolically. He did it in reality, you know, a simple, direct confrontation with the empire that said no to war, yes to life. And he called the arms race a larceny of the poor, which is exactly what it is. Look at these neighborhoods we're walking through here where he lived, among the poor. Can you imagine just a fraction of our defense budget going to these neighborhoods for reconstruction, for education, for social programs for the elderly, school children? It's astonishing. But we are addicted to war, you know. That's the thing we know best. And the thing we do best is war. And we have to get in touch with the better part of our nature.
Are you opposed to an invasion of Iraq?
Oh, of course I am. All the innocent people that will be slaughtered to oust that lunatic, you know. I'm just appalled, and I'm just horribly depressed of what we're faced with. And you know, we're going to have to pay for it. And I don't mean just economically. We have to pay for it with our humanity, our conscience, you know. We're going to pay dearly for it. And we'll probably never get much real information about what actually goes on there, except from you.
You're also a good friend of Dan Berrigan, who is at the head of this procession, Bill's brother.
Yeah. Well, Dan is my mentor. And when I came back to Catholicism in 1981, I met Phil and Dan while filming a docudrama, really, on the plowshare action at the King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. The documentary was done by Emile D'Antonio, a great documentary filmmaker, and he wanted to do a documentary about the whole action and the trial, and he was refused permission into the court. So after the trial, he got the transcript, and he dramatized the trial, and he had the defendants play themselves. So Dan and Phil and Molly Rush and John Schulkrat and all the rest of those wonderful plowshares in that first action actually played themselves in the documentary, and we shot it in an old church on the Upper West Side of Manhattan in 1981. And I played the judge, and it was my first introduction to these guys. And Dan had always been an inspiration to me through the 60s. And when he went to prison, I'll never forget his final statement to friends when someone questioned him about going to prison. They said, "Sure, Father Berrigan, it's all well and good for you to go to prison to oppose the war. What about us? We have children, and what's going to happen to them?" And Dan replied, "What's going to happen to them if you don't?" And that stuck in my brain and in my heart. I never forgot it. And a few years later, in 1986 it was, he invited me to a demonstration, and he said, "You should consider civil disobedience with us." And we were protesting Star Wars, which was being planned over on 42nd Street in the old McGraw-Hill Publishing Building. So I said, "Yeah." I was doing a film in New York with John Schlesinger at the time, and I had the day off, so I had no excuse. And I went to the demonstration, and I was arrested, and it was the happiest day of my life.
Jimmy Carter is getting the Nobel Peace Prize. Phil Berrigan never got honored in that way. Why not?
Well, he was not in the mainstream of peacemakers. He was personally involved all of his adult life in peacemaking. I mean, you know, Phil was actually a World War II combatant as well in Europe. He saw the devastation of war, and he felt the personal curse of war, and that really turned him around. And when he was ordained, you know, he joined the Josephite Order, which serves African-American people. In fact, this was, I believe it was Phil's first parish here. And so he remained committed to the poor and the marginalized and the ostracized. And he gave voice to the voiceless. And he did it all of his life. And, you know, the prize, a peace prize is, I mean, I'm delighted for Mr. Carter, and it's much deserved. But they would never really recognize someone like Phil Berrigan because he was not in the mainstream. He was radical, which is from the Latin word meaning root. His whole life was about peace. The prize was the commitment to do it, you know, and he did it for himself. As I say, he took the Gospels personally, and that's the way they're meant to be taken. You know, if they're not personal, if the command of the Gospel is not taken personal, then it's impersonal. So most people who call themselves Christians, myself included, it's more of an impersonal commitment rather than a personal one. As soon as you take the Gospels personally, then everything changes, you know. You have to do something about it, you know.
You played the judge in the trial of the first Plowshares Action, King of Prussia.
Yeah.
And they hammered on the warheads of a General Electric plant in Pennsylvania.
Yes, they did, yeah, and poured their blood on them, yeah.
You now work for General Electric,
yes,
which
I
owns
do.
NBC.
Yes. Yes, I know they do.
As
maybe
president
not
of the West.
Maybe not for long.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I'm an actor, and I've been an actor all my life, and I've been lucky enough to make my living at it. I've also been an active activist for the last 20 years of my life, and I cannot separate the two. You know, I consider myself an artist, and I have a voice in the community at large, so that I try to include my activism in my work as an actor and my work as an actor as an activist. I try to balance the two. I'm personally a big sissy. I could never do what Phil and Dan and so many of these good people do, which is go to prison for actions against war and militarism.
You have been arrested more than 60 times.
I have been, but I've never spent more than a few days in jail. And in fact, one of them was one of the great days of my life because I spent it in jail in D.C. with Phil Berrigan. But
what was that like?
Oh, that was great. You know, I didn't want to leave. They kind of threw us out in the night.
What was that action?
It was for the, we were protesting the closing of a subway in Washington that was used by the homeless for some residual heat at the height of the winter. And our friend, our mutual friend, Mitch Schneider, who ran the CCNV in Washington and created the homeless shelter, which is still there, asked me to come in to draw attention to this, and so I did. And I think I was in town 10 minutes before I was in custody, and Phil was there, and we spent the night in jail, and actually about 3 days, and it was great. It was, and when we were released, we took a bus from the jail back downtown, and none of us had any money, but I had a credit card, and we got off the bus in front of Union Station, and I spotted an Irish pub nearby, and I had a credit card, and so we all went there and had a great, great meal. It was one of the great times I remember of all the times I'd come to Washington and all the times I'd been with Phil.
Is there any move in Washington, in Hollywood now, to oppose the war?
Well, there is, but it's rather polite, you know, and it's very secular. It's not united by any means. You know, most of us are, you know, frankly, afraid of being unpatriotic if we voice anything but the popular opinion about patriotism, about supporting the government, about supporting this administration. But I think it's growing now. There are more and more people who are opposed to the war in Iraq specifically, see it as not a good thing for America and certainly not a good thing for Iraq. But it's not yet unified and it isn't specific. And it's more secular than anything else. It's not really anywhere, you know.
Are you concerned about the increasing cooperation of the Pentagon or Hollywood with the Pentagon with these films where they pour millions in as long as they get script approval?
It's true, yeah. It's a propaganda move. And Hollywood has been really always very cooperative with the government because they get to use all the equipment and they get to... have the imprimatur and the nihi obstat from the Pentagon, and it helps their box office. It also helps recruiting for the Pentagon. So it's a mutual admiration society in large measure. I don't say that with any judgment, really, because I'm equally involved in it. I've done war movies with not always the cooperation of the government, but furthered my own career by doing many violent parts and playing, quote, war heroes when I don't personally believe in that course. So I don't really have an axe to grind and I don't really have a pulpit to preach from, you know. I'm equally guilty.
You're here today.
Yeah, I'm here to celebrate this man and be with this peace community. I know these people for many years, and I adore them, and I wanted to just come and just be present in this spirited group and celebrate this man and be nurtured by all of this good stuff that these people give the world and just share their grief and celebrate their spirit and take home a measure of peace from them, which I always do when I come east, you know. We're so bereft of a real peace movement on the West Coast, you know. We're so fragmented and divided. And the East Coast seems to have a much more consolidated peace movement. And it's grounded in a spirituality that we don't really have on the West Coast. And I'm nurtured by that and inspired by it. And Phil was a giant, and he'll be with us now in different ways, but he'll always be with us. And so I'm very happy to be here. I wish it were different circumstances, but it's not. And so we have to accept the reality that physically he's gone from our midst, but spiritually he'll always be with us. Wherever the truth is spoken, wherever action is taken on behalf of the poor, the marginalized, the voiceless, wherever the gospel is taken personally, Phil Berrigan is present.
Martin Sheen, actor, standing outside St. Peter Claver Church in Baltimore as he followed the coffin of Philip Berrigan
Yes, Monday saw perhaps the largest gathering of ex-cons in the country. About 600 people gathered for the funeral of Philip Berrigan, Martin Sheen among them. He's been arrested more than 60 times protesting war. Philip Berrigan would have been proud. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Pulitzer Prize-winning reporters Donald Bartlett and James Steele talking about Wheel of Misfortune. Stay with us.
Now we're heading for a nasty business that keeps our country growing. Where the weapons that we're selling are the only seeds we're sowing. We get to blow the fruits of all your labor, sell our 16s to all the neighbors. That it's for money, and that's how the West gets bargained. You know, the last time this happened, even Vietnam got jargoned. And you can say they're out to hunt you, you can say they're out to fish you. You can join a gang or restless boys or start your own militia. You can even see.
Bought and sold, Dar Williams, who is also at Philip Berrigan's funeral. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The rich get richer. Fraud, corruption, intimidation, buying politicians, the white man wins again. Some of the subject headings in a special report, believe it or not, in this week's Time magazine. The article is not about Enron, WorldCom, or Halliburton. It's not about our campaign finance system, and it's not about a new war in Iraq. The article is about how white men are making millions off the Indian casino industry, while hundreds of thousands of Native Americans continue to live in poverty. The report begins. Imagine, if you will, Congress passing a bill to make Indian tribes more self-sufficient that gives billions of dollars to the white backers of Indian businesses and nothing to hundreds of thousands of Native Americans living in poverty. Or a bill that gives hundreds of millions of dollars to one Indian tribe with a few dozen members and not a penny to a tribe with hundreds of thousands of members. Or a bill that allows select Indian tribes to create businesses that reap millions of dollars in profits and pay no federal income tax at the same time that the tribes collect millions in aid from American taxpayers. Can't imagine Congress passing such a bill? Well, it did. Well, that's from the article Wheel of Misfortune, and we're joined in our firehouse studio by the two journalists who wrote the piece. Don Bartlett and James Steele are two of the most widely acclaimed investigative reporters in American journalism. Their work has earned them dozens of national awards as well as two Pulitzer Prizes. They're also authors of the best-selling book America, What Went Wrong, which remained on the New York Times bestseller list for 8 months. Don Bartlett and Jim Steele, thank you for joining us.
Nice to be with you, Amy.
Well, let's start out with the subject of this investigation, two-part. The next appears next week's Time magazine, Wheel of Misfortune, a special report on Indian casinos.
Amy, I think what you can safely say is that no one has ever gone broke by overestimating Congress's ability to produce a piece of legislation which will do the exact opposite of what it says it's going to do, and that was the case here. The Indian Gaming Regulatory Act in 1988 was so loophole-riddled that you could probably just see the Washington lawyers and lobbyists lined up to take advantage of it, as well as some very astute Native Americans. And we have to make it clear that this act, the casinos, have benefited a small, comparatively small number of Native Americans. Many of these tribes with the most profitable casinos have only a few dozen or a few hundred members. At the same time, you have, you know, a quarter million Navajo, 20% of whom still don't have indoor plumbing. And yet this was a piece of legislation that was supposed to make Indian tribes self-sufficient. It was economic development. It was to strengthen tribal governments. It has done none of those things for a majority of Indian tribes in this country.
Well, James Steele, let's talk about Solomon Kirzner as an example. Who is he?
He's one of the investors in the Mohegan Sun Casino in Connecticut. One of the things we found in looking at this whole issue is how many of these casinos basically got off the ground from seed money from investors, folks for the most part people have never heard of, and who in the early years of these casino development projects took basically 30 to 40% of the net profits depending on the agreement. Kirzner and his partners are going to share, if I'm not mistaken, about $800 million over the life of that agreement. But even he's a piker compared to the fellow who financed Foxwoods, who's a...
Well, just before we get to Foxwoods, tell us a little about the background of Solomon Kirzner.
Well, Kirzner got his start. Kirzner is South African, and he got his start building a casino in one of the homelands. Basically, his money is built out of apartheid, racism. South Africa prohibited casinos. The only place you could build one was in one of the homelands, those arbitrary areas that the South African government carved up for blacks. And this is where Kirzner cut his deal to build a casino, Sun City, which is sometimes referred to as Sin City. Enormously successful, very profitable. This gave him a huge wad of cash, which probably helped him to arrange financing for the Mohican Sun in Connecticut.
So from apartheid South Africa to what some call the apartheid of America, which is the Indian reservation system.
Absolutely. And the other thing about this is he had an exclusive franchise in South Africa. That casino was the only one permitted at the time. So what happens, he comes to the United States, and U.S. Congress has basically given a monopoly franchise to X number of tribes. And we say X number because this benefits really only those tribes who are located near metropolitan areas. And he takes advantage of the same system.
James Steele, Foxwood.
Foxwoods was financed by a Malaysian billionaire by the name of Lim Gotong. Obviously, most people in this country have never heard of this man. We computed over the life of the various agreements that he put in place to finance the casino that he and his family and various companies will probably walk away over the life of roughly $1 billion.
And what is Foxwoods?
Foxwoods is the biggest casino in the country. Actually, it calls itself the biggest casino in the world, located in southeastern Connecticut. Roughly 40,000 plus people a day go through there. It has more slot machines than any casino on the Las Vegas Strip. I think that's the thing about this whole subject that astonished us. People don't realize how rapidly Indian gaming, the industry, has grown. It's much larger than Vegas, much, much larger than Atlantic City. And this has happened in a very relatively short period of time.
And the Native American nation or tribe that has this casino?
A tribe by the name of the Mashantucket Pequot tribe, which was restored by Congress in the early 1980s, just had at the time roughly 200 members that reformed itself in part to develop the casino on the reservation. Obviously, the people there have done very well over time, but it's typical of what you find in most of the Indian casinos. Most of the tribes that have the very successful casinos, and there are a couple of exceptions, are very, very small tribes. In one California town we ran across, the tribe has 24 adult members, and the casino makes somewhere between $100 million. Doesn't make, but the revenues are somewhere between $100 million and $200 million a year.
You have to, and the two casinos in Connecticut between them, Foxwoods and Mohican Sun. Mohican Sun just became a $1 billion casino this year, two in revenue. So you're talking $2 billion for maybe 1,000 Native Americans. And that's revenue again, but those are the people who are benefiting. You know, a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of 1% of the 1.8 million Native Americans out there who live on or near reservations.
Well, one statistic might be worth it here. There's 290 Indian casinos. We estimate about four of them comprise probably 25% of the revenue. So that gives you an idea how few are really benefiting.
We're joined on the telephone right now, in addition to James Steele and Donald Bartlett, who are in our studios, who wrote the piece in this week's Time magazine called Wheel of Misfortune. We're joined by Lyle Berman, chair and CEO of Lakes Entertainment, Inc., a casino development company. According to Bartlett and Steele's report, Berman gambled on Indian gaming with his 1990 decision to join forces with the Minnesota tribe, the Mi'kmaq band of Ojibwe Indians, and build a casino on its reservation 70 miles north of Minneapolis. In return for managing the place, Berman and his partners got 40% of the profits for 7 years, after which the tribe took over. And then Lyle Berman went on to back three more Indian ventures, Grand Casino Hinckley, also in Minnesota, and two casinos in Louisiana. Today, Berman has deals to develop five more Indian casinos, three in California and Massachusetts, one in Michigan, at a prime spot just 70 miles east of Chicago. Can you talk, Lyle Berman, about the benefits of the Native American casino system in this country? Are you yourself Native American?
No, I'm not. But the benefits of Indian gaming for Native American tribes is extensive. There are many, many casinos in the United States on Indian lands. They built them. They've created jobs for Native Americans as well as non-Native Americans. They've built schools on their schools, medical clinics. One tribal chairman drove me around his reservation after we had opened the casino for 3 years and very proudly pointed to over 100 homes that the tribe had built and or lent money to their members so they could build homes. So I think this article is very misstated. Indian gaming has benefited a large number of tribes and Native Americans. It is true that there are some extremes on both ends. There are extremes where several very large casinos have very small membership and make a lot of money, but the fact is that that's just the other extreme is where there are incredibly large tribes like the Navajos, the Apache, several others. They have large reservations, large tracts of land where there aren't a lot of people, and therefore their casinos, if they have them there.
Navajos don't have casinos, right? They don't believe in
it. No, but aren't particularly profitable. But that takes nothing away from the all the middle tribes that have, you know, nice casinos making revenue for the tribes, making them self-sufficient.
Don Barlett?
I also, as a company that invests in, and I suggest we didn't gamble with the Mille Lacs Band, we invested with the Mille Lacs Band. And when you look at some of the casinos where investors like ourselves have not only invested money but managed the casinos for the tribe for the first 7 years, the article would infer that we have gotten our money from the tribes, and nothing could be further from the truth. What we did is we created large enterprises for the tribes that they didn't have the economic means to do themselves, and the monies that we received for our investments came from the public. The tribes made far more money by having us build casinos and manage them for them for 7 years than they ever could have done on their own.
Don Barlett.
I don't think there's any question about that. The Indians would not have had access to capital markets, didn't back at that time that Mr. Berman began, no question about that. That's not true today. Now, of course, they can. But here's one interesting statistic on Mr. Berman's two casinos in Minnesota. There are more slot machines in the two casinos than there are Indians. And that really sums up the disparity of what's happening out there. And he actually has been involved with a couple of the bigger tribes in terms of money. It is true that there are a number of kind of mid-sized casinos which have, generated jobs for local tribe members. But the overwhelming majority of employees in Indian casinos are non-Indians. And it's just overwhelming. It's staggering. They're not Indians at all. It has generated revenue for some tribal programs, and actually we're going to deal with that in part two that comes next week, and we analyze exactly what has happened to the money in those situations.
The point he makes about so many of the large tribes being in places that are far from metropolitan areas is absolutely right, and we made that point in great detail in the article. But the point we also tried to make is that the perception of a lot of the public is that Indian gaming has been a huge boon for Native Americans. And this is simply not true. And when we were doing the research on this, I can't tell you the number of people we talked to. We said, what is your perception of this? What do you think is happening? And the average person out in the public thinks Native Americans are walking around with money stuffed out of their pockets. And it simply isn't true. 90% of Native Americans are not touched by this at all. Another 5 to 6% barely derive any benefit at all from it. It goes to a handful of people. That was the thrust, really, of the article.
And this wouldn't be so, this is fine, but Congress sold this legislation on the basis of economic development for all Indians. It sold it on the basis of a strong tribal government for all Indians, not for Indians near big cities, but for all Indians. And in that sense, this has been one of just a colossal failure.
In the piece, you write that Lyle Berman, by your own estimate said you're worth almost $69 million by September 2001. In 99, a predecessor company, Lakes Gambling, which was publicly owned, earned close to $55 million in management fee income and had a net profit of $28.8 million. In 96, Lau Berman's compensation package totaled $18 million in salary and stock options, what executive compensation guru Grafe Crystal called the third most outrageous in the U.S. Your response, Mr. Berman?
Well, I don't respond on, he wasn't quoting me when I gave him all those articles, and I wouldn't comment on my own personal net worth. But on the salary part, the majority of that money came not from stock options, but it came actually from stock that I had owned. And I guess I can't comment any further on that.
Your conclusion in your report, who gets the money? Needy Native Americans, you'd think, but Indian casinos are making millions for their investors and providing little to the poor. Who ultimately pushed this through Congress?
The original act came because many Indian reservations, bingo was developing, and it was sort of unregulated in part. A number of tribes had hit on bingo as partly an economic development tool. It was a very small number as it was, and a number of Supreme Court decisions had basically sanctioned this and said any efforts by states to regulate this were improper. So that set the stage for Congress passing in part this regulatory act. But within it, they made a significant point that one of the reasons for it was economic development, and people talked about the generations, all the years people had tried to develop economic development programs on Indian reservations, how those had failed. This was seen as a way, in part, to get some of that going.
Well, Jim Bartlett and Jim Steele and Don Bartlett, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Look Who's Cashing In at Indian Casinos. Also, Lyle Berman on the line with us, Chair and CEO of Lakes Entertainment, as we end with the words of American Indian Movement's Russell Means, the American Indian Movement opposed to gambling.
As I've stated over and over and over again, this is the colonial setup, the casinos designed for the tribal government. All the casinos are designed for tribal governments because that's where the graft and corruption is. It's really a stroke. What happened in the beginning was that we outsmarted the Bureau of Indian Affairs, which, I mean, a kindergartner can do that. But we outsmarted the Bureau of Indian Affairs in getting gaming. Okay, it started with high-stakes bingo in Florida among the Seminoles who live literally across the street from Hollywood, Florida. They started a high-stakes bingo there. Well, here's how they did it. They went to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, because you have to get permission for everything. So they go to the Bureau, and we said, we want to have a bingo, you know, like the Catholics. Oh, sure, go ahead. Well, they had Jewish backers down there in Florida and high-stakes backers, and they started high-stakes bingo. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs was quite perturbed there for about a decade. And finally, they figured out how to circumvent it by passing a national law, an illegal law, I might add. But these tribal governments will never contest their existence, you know? It's a classical. So it teaches greed, pure and simple. It's all it teaches, greed.
That was Russell Means, interviewed by Brett Baer on the Pine Ridge Reservation. That does it for the show. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Nogueira, Alex Wolf, Rich Kim, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.